You are listening to 1370 Connection, as you have just heard President Obama speaking from the White House, reacting, of course, to the Supreme Court decision handed down just a little over 2 hours ago, which essentially sustained the entirety of the health care reform plan, known as the Affordable Health Care Act, and known colloquially as Obamacare, because it was a signature policy initiative of the current president's administration. It lives. The Supreme Court has kept the whole package in place and legal in a narrow 5-4 decision written by Chief Justice Roberts, who declared that the controversial individual mandate for coverage might not have been something Congress could legislate under the Commerce Clause, as many of its advocates had suggested, but is something that Congress and the president could legally do under their power to tax, because a tax is basically what the mandate and all of the various penalties attached to it essentially is. And so it stands. And so does everything else in the bill. We're going to examine the future of health care next hour and what should be the future of health care. And you'll be invited at that time to call in at 263-WXXI. We're not going to be taking calls this hour because of technical reasons and because we want to have the opportunity to bring in experts from all sides to look at the policy implications and the legal implications as the Affordable Care Act moves ahead. Right now, we have with us on the line, looking at the law, we have Kate Sarasine of the Rochester-based national law firm of Nixon Peabody, a specialist in employee benefit law and all of the issues that relate to health care, especially as most people get it through their employers. We'll be joined shortly by Fran Weisberg, executive director of the Finger Lakes Health Systems Agency. And we understand that we have both Fran and Kate on the line. And I welcome you both to the program. And thank you very much for taking the time to join us right now.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Bob.
Now, here's the bottom line, and let's get to the legal aspect first, Kate, and you can help me out on this. As I understand this, and it looks like some of the media reports that came out right as the decision was being released didn't figure this out. Justice Roberts said that the whole health care package stays alive despite undermining one of its rationales, the whole Commerce Clause argument, because it's a tax, and Congress and the president, working in concert together like every law, has the power to tax for whatever purpose they deem right and fair. And essentially, because it's a tax, it stands. Am I getting that right?
You are. And I think that what happened was that in everyone's haste to try to tell everybody what the decision was, they didn't read far enough into the opinion to get to the part where Justice Roberts saved the law under the taxing power. The first thing he said is that it was not constitutional under the Commerce Power. Then he said it was not constitutional under the Necessary and Proper Clause. But it's always the Supreme Court's position that if it can save a law by making a reasonable interpretation that would be constitutional, that it will do that. And that's what the court has done here. They have determined that it would be reasonable to interpret the law as a tax. And that is how it saved the individual mandate under the taxing power.
In a sense, that's logical because, let's face it, if there's a payment that you have to make to the government for a public purpose, yeah, by definition, that's a tax, isn't it?
Right. And that's how the government runs the Medicare system, for example. Everybody pays in out of their wages a tax, and that's how you get Medicare when you're able to retire. Here it's a little bit different because it's not a mandatory payment for everyone. It's only a payment owed by those individuals who do not have minimum essential coverage. And that's why people were arguing that perhaps it wasn't constitutional. But Justice Roberts says it stands.
Well, I mean, the same thing as, let's face it, car insurance. You don't have to have it, but you sure do have to have it if you drive a car. And you have to pay a license fee to register your car to the state if you have a car. Not everybody has to have a car, so they don't all have to pay it. But if you've got it, you got to pay it.
That's right. And if it were the state that were imposing the mandate, I think it would be a totally different set of arguments. Here the question was whether or not the federal government could require people to buy health insurance. And the decision is, well, no, you can't require people to do that. but you can require them to pay a tax if they don't.
And so the law stands. That's a pretty finely sliced piece of logic. It's subtle. It's interesting. It gives you a lot of insight into the way John Roberts thinks, doesn't it?
It does, and it's interesting because portions of this opinion are written by Justice Roberts without the other judges who support the outcome joining in the same section of the opinion. There are actually several different opinions here. You've got Justice Roberts writing by himself. You've got Justice Ginsburg writing with various other justices joining in. And then you have a set of dissenting justices who sometimes agree with Justice Roberts. So it's very hard to slice and dice this one, but you know, the bottom line is that the whole law survives.
You get would I be right in saying that this is something that John Roberts probably wouldn't have written unless he felt that he absolutely had to? That he didn't really like the outcome himself, but hey, I'm not the legislature, I'm not the president, I can't make that call. They've made the call, and even if I don't like it, I've got to let it stand.
You know, I don't like to opine on what he may think personally, but it was interesting. There was a line in the opinion where he said that he would have upheld the law under the Commerce Clause if the Constitution allowed him. So it almost made it sound as though he, you know, it was in support of the law. But you never want to try to get inside the personal opinions of the justices.
And then there was something else, too. I think he had a disclaimer somewhere in there about asking people not to read this decision or any other as necessarily an endorsement of the underlying policy, just a recognition that that policy is perfectly legal for the policymakers to make.
Well, and I haven't come across that line yet. It's a 193-page opinion, which I'm honestly still working my way through, but that is the position that the court takes. You know, they're not trying to uphold or strike down a law based on their opinions, but just on whether or not it was legal for Congress to pass such a law.
Now, I want at this point to both bring Fred Weisberg into the discussion, looking at the policy implications, and also ask you, Kate, as well, to look at it from the point of view of some of the people whom you deal with and advise as business operators who are providing benefits for their employees. Let's look at it from the aspect of who this is going to affect. I mean, first of all, does it have any effect at all on people who are now working and getting a pretty comprehensive, pretty broad menu policy coverage for themselves and perhaps for their families as well for the place they work?
Probably not. You know, some employers or many employers allow employees to opt out of health insurance altogether. So there is a group of employees who are offered health insurance sponsored by their employer where the employer would pay a large chunk of the cost of that health insurance, but they nevertheless opt out because they, you know, perhaps feel that they're healthy and that they don't need it.
So does that mean they're not going to be able to opt out that way anymore, that they're going to have to take the benefit then?
Bob, I think there's a lot of issues that do affect everybody in our community and throughout the nation. So, first of all, I do think this is an historic and exciting decision for all of Americans, and I do applaud the court for upholding the act because I do believe this will ultimately ensure that people get the care they need when they need it. As well, as a result of this decision, more than 46,000 uninsured folks in our own community will have access to coverage. I also do believe this act is more than just about comprehensive coverage. It really begins to take on measures necessary to fix the healthcare system that is too expensive, unsustainable, and also doesn't deliver better high-quality care and better access to care. This does by actually giving the coverage. There are many other parts to this that looks at trying to make sure that we have a less fragmented system and a better coordinated system of care at the community primary care level.
And who will get care, perhaps, and will get insurance for that care, who up to now had to show up at the ER?
Exactly. Exactly. Who? First of all, you are so right that what happens is all the data shows, and we're a data shop, that when people don't have health care insurance, they wait a far longer time before they go seek help from their doctor. Then by the time they actually go somewhere, they end up going to an emergency room, are far sicker than they needed to be, and they end up in the most expensive care, that acute care bed, which is not what we want. We want people to stay healthier. We want to be able to manage folks' care at the community level with their primary care doctor, and then only go into the hospital when they really, really need it. All of that, which is what this new act is also about, should over time truly bend the cost curve, decrease the cost of care, and improve quality.
So is that
That's
going
for
to
everybody?
Yeah. Is that going to necessarily mean that if more people get covered, let's start with the price that we're all paying right now or that our employers are paying. And yeah, most of our employers are paying most of the cost of our health insurance.
Yep.
So are they going to end up with more people into the pool paying less?
Well, first of all, I think there is more and more where the individual is paying more the cost of his or her own care. That is where this has been going. I think there will be less cost shifting when you have everybody covered. For example, when somebody goes to the hospital and has no health insurance, somebody's paying that bill. So now you're going to have more direct care. Somebody is covered. They get care more quickly. It's more cost-effective care. So the cost shifting is far, far less. So over time, more and more people will be covered, and then the cost of care will go down in the aggregate across the entire system.
More people get covered, and the cost per person covered may go down.
Exactly. In the beginning, this will cost more money. But again, if people go see their doctor instead of going to an emergency room or instead of waiting until the very end when they have complications from diabetes or when they're very, very ill with heart trouble, instead of ending up in an emergency room or a hospital bed, they get their care better coordinated and managed. It will, everything in the world says, improving quality and decreasing costs. That's what we're really striving for now.
Here's something that may or may not apply in New York State, because New York has gone ahead and made its Medicaid benefit part of the whole equation more generous and broader in its scope than most other states, maybe any other state. But here's the crux of some of it. There's been a question, and it was raised in the litigation, of whether the federal government could force states to expand their share of Medicaid costs and administration. Something which, by the way, New York already went ahead and did because it thought it was a good idea on its own hook.
Right.
Well, according to the reports I've seen, yes, the federal government can do that. But by the same token, they took away some of the teeth because the federal government was told as well it can't remove any existing Medicaid funding, even if the states refuse not to join into the new program. They still get whatever funding they were already entitled to for whatever they were doing. All they do is miss out on the added funding for the added programs that they don't bother covering. Maybe, I guess, that's good news for New York because it gets a cut, but nobody else loses. Is that the way it's actually going to come down? It's going to be a benefit, a carrot without any stick?
Absolutely not. Bob, actually, New York State is leading the way. It's called the Medicaid Redesign Team. The governor has created a Medicaid czar. In fact, our Medicaid is some of the highest in the country, and it's not something to be very proud of. I think we needed to be looking at the cost of our Medicaid services. It didn't even lead to the greatest quality in the world. So what our state's really also doing is how do we create better quality care, more coordinated care, where every person on Medicaid, whether you're an older adult on Medicaid and Medicare, whether you're a person with a developmental disability or you've run out of funds, you will no longer have what's called fee-for-service care. You will be under a system that is capitated and better coordinated so we improve quality and decrease cost. It is the major initiative of this state and this governor to improve quality and decrease cost. And that's very similar to what the feds are doing. So So we cannot just cover people. We need to really take time. We have an unsustainable health care system in our state and in the country. So a lot of this is about decreasing costs, let's be clear.
So, Bob, I'm going to jump back in to answer your question about the carrot versus the stick. In terms of what the Supreme Court said, it was exactly how you characterized it, that the government can use the carrot, but they can't use the stick. They can offer additional money for the states who will expand the Medicaid eligibility to cover these additional people, but they cannot take away the existing funding if they refuse to. And that was what the health care law had been drafted to do. But because the health care law had a severability clause in it, it said if any part of this law is unconstitutional or unenforceable, the rest of the law survives. That's how they've read it. So the Medicaid incentives can stay, but the feds cannot withdraw money from the states who refuse to expand eligibility.
All of which is moot in New York's case anyway, because New York was buying into the whole concept and going ahead and sort of creating its own initiatives then. But those states that choose to fall behind and do it the old-fashioned way could go ahead and do it the old-fashioned way if they want it, right?
That's right.
And does that impact everybody here to any degree at all? If only because it might very well impact insurance costs in some way or another, especially for those who get their insurance coverage from nationwide or interstate sources rather than from sources based in New York?
It could. A lot of employers, for example, will buy a policy issued out of a single state that covers employees nationwide, regardless of what state they reside in. So if, employees locally are working for employers like that who are buying policies out of other states and those policy premiums have to go up as a result, it certainly could impact people here.
But is it necessarily given, especially the fact that most employers buy their employee health insurance from local sources like Excellus or MVP? Is that going to make much difference in practice since Excellus's and MVP's customer base is essentially in-state? Is that going to make much difference here at all?
I agree with you, Bob. We don't think it's going to make that big of a difference.
Yeah, and I don't think that it would either. The larger employers here that really have a national scope tend to be self-insured. So they're not paying the premiums to the insurance companies. Right. They're paying claims directly out of their pocket for what their own employees incur. So I agree. I think the impact here locally is going to be minimal.
We're talking with Fran Weisberg of the Finger Lakes Health Systems Agency and attorney Kate Saracene of the Rochester-based national law firm of Nixon Peabody, both of them specialists in various aspects of health care policy and its impact on individuals and families here in the area. Ms. Saracene is a legal specialist in employee benefits, and let's face it, most people are insured for health care through their or a family member's employer. And Fred Weisberg is a specialist in public policy and the coordination of health care provision among public and private providers in the region. And of course, we want to remind you as well, stay with us. Starting in the second hour of the program, we'll be opening up the phones at 263-WXXI, 263-9994, to talk about the implications of the Affordable Health Care Act Supreme Court decision, and hearing from Dr. Lawrence Jacobs of the University of Rochester, who says that even though Obamacare lives, still isn't enough, still shouldn't be the last word on health care reform. He'll tell you what he means on that during the second hour of the program, right after the news. Meanwhile, let's look as well at where we might be going from here. 2014 is kind of an interesting date because a lot of things in this law kick in 2 years from now. Why is 2014 an important date? What does it offer to people over and above what they've already seen? And then as well, what does it mean, other than perhaps the time that the mandate kicks in? And Kate, I'll begin with you. Just looking at it from the employer's aspect and looking at it from the legal aspect of things, what does 2014 mean?
Okay. Well, 2014 is when the next wave of big reforms come into play. We saw a number of them happen in 2010. There's a few trickling in the next couple of years, but 1/1/14 is when you see the tax penalties appear, both for the individual mandate and also the employer penalties. If the employers do not provide a minimum level of health insurance for reasonable costs. The employers themselves are going to have to pay tax penalties. 2014 is also the year when no employer will be able to make an employee wait more than 90 days before they're eligible for health insurance policies. Today, employers are allowed to make employees wait longer than 90 days, and that mandate really applies just to full-time employees. Part-time employees still won't be necessarily entitled to health insurance coverage.
And so that's the big drop-dead date, essentially, when the most important and, I guess, in a lot of ways, most controversial provision kicks in. And in the meantime, what have we already gotten from it in positive terms and in terms of the stick as well as the carrot?
Well, and Bob, and Kate, correct me, I think the exchange, each state really implements this exchange, which is how we're going to ensure the coverage, where people can go on this exchange and buy their coverage. That also, you know, the key turns on that in 2014. So that's the mechanism by which people will be able to get the coverage.
That's right. Yeah, the exchanges have been forming in the meanwhile, but by 2014, they should all be operational and they'll be opened up to employers with less than 100 employees.
So, and the other things that have already started, which is also very, very important, as many people know, it's those students and young people that have not had insurance and up to the age of 26, they can stay on their parents' coverage. That's huge.
And the other huge thing was the elimination of the pre-existing condition exclusions.
Huge.
You know, here in New York State, we already had eliminated the pre-existing condition exclusions, but in other states, they're still alive and well. In 2010, we eliminated them with respect to children under age 19, but in 2014, they'll be eliminated across the board for everyone.
And also the donut hole for those elders that fell between the cracks of not being able to get Part D and prescription drugs, the Act remedied that situation.
Now, that, of course, is something that's specific to retirees, people who are Medicare eligible, and most of them are no longer living with employer-provided health care, except maybe some of them, and unfortunately fewer of them now every year, some of them were covered under agreements with their employers, either benefits that they had as a result of long tenure or benefits that they had through union contracts or what have you. This may be something of particular interest to, for example, Kodak retirees who right now are kind of on tenterhooks, wondering if the company is going to be able to continue the level of retiree benefits that is provided up to now under the bankruptcy or following the bankruptcy. They just don't know. Kodak's been told it can't cut them off just yet, but they're wondering what's going to happen a few months down the road as the whole bankruptcy comes closer to final resolution. What's going to happen that may possibly affect people like that? Wondering what will happen to their supplemental benefits over and above whatever they get in Medicare, or for that matter, those who retired early before the age of 65 and don't qualify for Medicare yet.
Well, the healthcare exchanges are going to make plans available to those individuals. And some of the mandates are going to require that insurers have to sell coverage to anyone who applies for it, and that they cannot charge higher rates to people based on their health status. So this is especially important for those early retirees. Even the major companies who have been offering retiree coverage have been scaling back on that coverage. You know, they're still offering it, but employees have to pay the full cost, which, you know, can be unaffordable for people. Or sometimes they're grandfathering and saying, well, anybody who retired before a certain date, we're keeping the coverage intact, but no new retirees get it. So the exchanges and these new rules about access are going to be very important to that group.
Now, it is possible, as I understand it, that current retirees' benefits who are in that situation could possibly change based on company decisions. So that's, I guess, not only true of Kodak, but true of a lot of companies that are finding that they're under the gun cost-wise and having trouble continuing to pay for and cover these benefits into the future. But will this make it perhaps somewhat easier, more affordable for either the companies to continue providing it or for individuals to provide that supplemental coverage on their own, which can still cost a substantial amount of money?
Right. Actually, there, as I was saying earlier, there is a great deal in this act under the Medicare system that really looks at bending the cost curve, decreasing the cost of care. There is tremendous amounts of duplication, replication, and ineffective care that's being provided right now. So there are tremendous incentives in this act to have better coordinated care and to talk about what kind of care works versus what does not work. What kind of technology do you really need? What kind of meds work? What doesn't work? What kind of interventions work? So that's another very critical part of this act, so that we are looking at a more sustainable system, and we in Rochester are doing that a great deal right now, looking at what's the most effective kind of care and providing that care, not the more expensive care.
And Bob, there were also a number of direct employer incentives in this law to maintain retiree health insurance for these groups we've been talking about. There was the early retiree reimbursement program where the government set aside $5 billion to give money back to employers who are covering early retirees who had high claims expense. And that program has been working, and I've had a number of clients receiving subsidies under that program.
Bottom line, then, is in a way, it almost sounds like we continue on with a lot of the plans that got started when this law was passed, that we just move forward and continue to build it into future assumptions on a corporate level, on an individual level, and on a community level as well. So the dialogue that we've had is going to continue with this law as sort of the foundation of it. Looking forward, can we expect, first of all, that overall costs of health insurance and of health care from the provider will moderate, that we won't see these huge spikes in cost year after year after year that have put a lot of stresses on companies buying insurance, on insurers themselves, especially the nonprofit ones, and on the healthcare providers, the hospitals, the doctors, the clinics?
We believe this will decrease the acceleration of, do you know what I mean? This has been going the wrong direction. We've had true, very dramatic increases in the cost of care. We have to, you know, decrease the rate of the increase. And I believe this starts that journey.
So does it do it basically just like putting more people into the pool, so to speak?
That's one way. Again, you're getting rid of the cost shifting. But there is a tremendous amount in this act about how we provide care more efficiently and smartly. And, you know, we in this community just got a huge grant from the CMS Innovation Center to redesign and transform the primary care office by putting in care managers, people that are navigators, that help the patient and the doctor to navigate their care better, to do more electronic medical records, to have other kinds of care workers that really ensure that there's the right care at the right time. So these kinds of new systems of care are really what I think will drive a more effective healthcare system. Because, again, what we keep saying, right now the healthcare system is too expensive, unsustainable, and it doesn't deliver better quality. There is a huge part of this new act that really looks at innovation, best practice, and really, and simple things, what Kate was saying earlier, they will stop paying for readmissions in 2014. So if a person keeps going back to the hospital for the wrong reason that it could have been prevented if they had only had better care in the community, they won't get reimbursed for that admission.
So bottom line is there a sort of implicit penalty to tell the healthcare provider, get it right the first time?
Yes. Well, there's both. Again, I do believe there's carrot and stick in this. There is going to be incentives to do it right, but penalties eventually if you don't change.
Kate, from the employer's point of view, and I'm asking you to sort of put yourself in the place of many of your clients here, are some employers that maybe have even been thinking about scaling back or dropping their commitment to providing health insurance for employees going to rethink that and step back and say, nah, I'm not going to cut them loose. I'm going to keep them up. And will some employers that up to now haven't provided for it or have provided only very rudimentary catastrophic care coverage going to offer a better menu of coverage for their employees and their families from here on in?
You know, interestingly, the tax penalty that applies to employers requires employers to provide minimum essential coverage. And the description of that coverage really is the catastrophic coverage. It's coverage that pays on average 60% of claims. You know, that's what we view today as a high deductible plan that's unmanageable for most employees. So employers aren't going to need to put in better coverage. I think the minimum level here is probably less than what a lot of employers are providing today. I think initially some employers are going to be incented to join the system and provide coverage for their employees that they didn't provide before. But honestly, the tax penalties are pretty small, and it won't be more than a few years before employers start doing that mathematical analysis and deciding that it's much cheaper for them to pay the small penalties than to foot the bill to provide the coverage.
So could some people decide, just say, I'm going to cut my employees loose completely and pay the small penalty? And could they decide basically, I mean, as heartless as this may sound, to let their employees fend for themselves in that sense? And will we see a lot of that, which might lead to the next phase of demands for more reform?
Bob, as the head of the Finger Lakes Health Systems Agency, I'm hoping that doesn't happen in our community. I am very proud of our business community right now. The RBA has a healthcare group. We are very involved with them. I think they care dearly about improving quality, decreasing costs. We have a huge high blood pressure initiative going on as a community. I think business is taking the health of their employees very seriously. And let's hope, while people could try to schnooker the system or whatever, I see business as leading the way in our community. And that's what we live here in really saying, how do we help our employees stay healthier and not need these higher level of cares? And that's what we want to continue doing as a community. I'm sure that some might say, let's go fend for yourself, but I'm not seeing it by the business community in our community.
And I agree. It's so ingrained in the business culture here. I mean, when
Thank
I joined Xerox in 1994, they were renowned as having the best benefits in the country. Rochester has always cared very much about providing benefits to its employees.
And we are lucky here.
And of course, the bottom line is, since any company could do it right now and would have faced no penalty at all for doing it up to now, I guess the small penalty that's inherent in this new law would just be a small additional disincentive, wouldn't it? And it wouldn't necessarily mean a decision maker one way or the other, would it? I mean, they just either provide coverage or not provide coverage anyway, and there's nothing new in this that would give them an extra incentive to cut their employees loose, really, is there?
That's right. I think the incentive is to provide coverage for your employees if you haven't been. There may come a point where the costs are so high that employers start to explore whether they would consider dropping coverage. And I've talked to some clients who, thought about it fleetingly and quickly decided it was just too important to their corporate culture and that they do not plan to go down that path.
And I am thrilled to hear that, Kate, because we have in this community not only the Finger Lakes Health Systems Agency and what the RBA is doing, but this community has formed something called the Rochester Health Innovation Collaborative, chaired by Assemblyman Morelli. But the vice chair is Paul Speranza from Wegmans, the deputy mayor, Len Reedon, and many, many business leaders, Larry Becker from Xerox, Paychex. There are many, many people that are all sitting at this table to say, what's our strategic vision of a high-performing healthcare system, keeping people healthy, and how do we guarantee that as our community? That continues the amazing, vision of Rochester and Rochester business leading the way on this. So I think that's what we want to keep going.
And our thanks to our guests of this hour. Our thanks to Fran Weisberg, who is the executive director of the Finger Lakes Health Systems Agency, and Kate Saracene, attorney with the Rochester-based national law firm of Nixon Peabody and a specialist in the law concerning employee benefits. I thank you both for being with us and helping us set in perspective the impact of what has happened today in the Supreme Court upholding the Affordable Health Care Act.